This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy. This is iFanboy Books Blow, Daredevil Born Again.
It's hard to be fair when you're fighting. It's hard to be nice when you lose. You wish you were thunder and lightning, but all you are is stuck with the blues. Yeah, you're stuck with the blues. So you gotta be lost to be found. The devil spins the world around. For you know the sun's up and
Hello, welcome to iFanboy Booksplode, Daredevil Born Again. My name is Connor Kilpatrick. I'm here with Josh Flanagan.
It's so good!
We are here. Booksplode, this is our biannual. It's our bi-monthly. Every other month, we do a Booksplode, which we talk about a graphic novel, a collected edition, a trade paperback, whatever you want to call it, a single volume of a series. And this month is Born Again from Frank Miller and David Mazzucchelli. You had never read it, and I'd read it a long time ago and basically didn't remember it. So this was basically like coming into it fresh for both of us, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Born Again is a collection of issues, Daredevil number 227 through 233, and it also includes, oddly, at least the collection we read, 226 at the end. So it really fucks everything up, because then you're reading the issue from beforehand at the end of it.
I think they should have put it at the beginning.
Yeah, it was a weird decision, at least in this volume. Or just not even included. I think they included it because it was with Miller and Mazzucchelli, kind of. It was Denny O'Neill and Miller.
It was their first collaboration.
Yeah, but it wasn't of the piece. It's just didn't look.
It still led into it because like we got to meet Glory and like.
Sure.
Yeah.
Anyway,
either way,
it's not really important to the Born Again 227 to 233. And so before we get into the book itself, and we'll talk about how great it is. Interesting facts about this. I was looking it up after reading it.
Yeah, I have some too.
So, crazily enough, this came out in 1986, the same year Miller did The Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah.
I mean, is it the best year anyone's ever had in comics?
I thought about this question. I thought long and hard. And as I was reading this, I said, you know, like, this is making a real claim to fame that Frank Miller, you know, at this point, I don't know if he's the best writer in comics, but he's clearly set a tone that has been copied since then. One could say even more than Alan Moore did.
Yes.
In terms of people trying to ape a style and try to keep a thing going, you know, 86 of the year that comics changed, blah, blah, blah. At the same time, what he did with art over in Dark Knight Returns at the same time, I don't know that that's a 1-2 punch that's ever been, other than Stan and Jack.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Other than the creation and the Golden Age, I can't imagine anyone having a year in which they put out two works of the caliber. I mean,
that people are still talking about.
What I would consider the best Batman story of all time, and what I think you have to consider probably the best Daredevil story of all time.
Yeah. I texted you, I think, as I was reading this. I was like, I'm 30 pages into this. This is the best Daredevil story I've ever read.
I couldn't put it down. I was ready to talk to you about it immediately, yep. And then we can just spend the next 3 or 4 pick of the weeks talking about it instead of whatever else comes out, because it's not going to be as good as this.
I did think, I was just like, what is the point of comics after this?
So the inciting incident of Daredevil Born Again is that, and this is, we're going to get into why I'm mentioning this now, is that Karen Page, Daredevil's longtime on and off girlfriend, is strung out in heroin, doing adult films to pay for her habit, and she sells Daredevil's identity to the sleazy guy she's with. She's got an envelope with Daredevil's real name in it, and she sells it to him for heroin. He sells it up the chain to Kingpin, and that leads the whole story off. But what's interesting about that
is... It's a page and a half.
Yeah. What's interesting about that is Karen Page hadn't been in the books since 1972. This was her first time back. So I looked this up because I couldn't remember how she'd gotten into heroin and adult films. She was Matt and Foggy's assistant. She started dating Matt. They were on and off, you know, in relationships. And then in 1972, Daredevil number 86, she left to go to Hollywood to be an actress. And then she does not appear in the book again until 227.
That's great.
That is crazy. She went off. She made a couple of appearances. She was in a Ghost Rider series because she was in a movie with Johnny Blaze. So they had an adventure together, which is crazy. In 1975, so 3 years later.
So this would have been when Frank Miller was a kid.
And then in 78, she was in a Marvel 2-in-1 adventure with The Thing, also taking place in Hollywood. But she hadn't been in Daredevil, and she hadn't been seen since 78. So this is 78 to 86. She hadn't been seen in comics. This is her first appearance back. She's strung out in heroin doing adult films and selling Daredevil's identity to up the chain to Kingpin. This is a crazy callback from Frank Miller. Frank Miller, who, by the way, was 29 years old, and David Mazzucchelli was 26 years old when they made this book.
Oh, you know what? The closest thing I could come with, and I was thinking about somebody being, A, pretty young, and B, doing stuff that was great, is like Garth Ennis around the time of Preacher and Hitman and Hellblazer.
Yes, that would be similar.
But even those are not, other than Preacher, they're not close to iconic. In fact, not even Preacher, really.
So... the main story here is that, as we said, Karen Page sells Matt's identity, goes up to Kingpin, he gets it, and he proceeds to systematically dismantle Matt's life on every level, and Matt spirals out of control and has to become born again to get his life back. And this is amazing. It's really, on all levels. I mean, Mazzucchelli would, a couple of years later, do Batman Year One in a very distinct style, and then... we would see him again with Asterios Polyp in a completely different style. And both of those styles are in this book.
All right, let's
including like five other styles he does in this book.
It's going to be real hard not to bounce around.
We're going to be bouncing around, I think.
I know, but let's talk about the story and the writing.
Okay.
And some of these things will meld. The thing I noticed about the writing, the art does complement this quite a bit. It's a pretty ruthless style of story in that it makes up a lot of ground and it takes big steps. What I mean is that the things that happen tend to happen really quickly, really sort of efficiently in a comic book form. And then we hang out in moments for a while. But if you know, like I was saying at the beginning, you know, it's a page and a half. It's already gone up to Daredevil in the chain. By the end of that first issue, his life's been ruined. You know, that happens very quickly. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of things where I was like, he's really being economical and not showing you every detail about things to get the story moving to where he wants to spend time.
This is the period where the Bronze Age is ending and the modern age is being invented in this book along with The Dark Knight and Watchmen. So we're seeing a whole new storytelling technique. If you read 226 in comparison, where Denny O'Neil was the co-writer, it's an entirely different kind of storytelling.
Yeah.
And so you can see he's creating a new comic book language in this story along with Dark Knight.
Yeah, but it was so... well done. Like I was just sort of watching how he'd put the panels together, and it's important to note, like, this isn't a fast read. Like, these are dense, and not in a bad way, not like there's too much there, but really squeezing everything out of all those pages at the same time while he's moving really quickly.
That's interesting. I didn't find it. I mean, I flew through this. I flew through it.
I don't mean that it's a quick read. No, I read it in that way, but what I'm saying is, like, there's a ton of character development. Yes. There are a lot. There's actually just literally a lot of words on the page. There's a lot of story here. It's not heavy, but it's not like those ones where, like, it opens up sometimes, like during an action scene where there's not a lot of dialogue and there's sound effects and things like that.
Yeah.
But it's not, you know, the decompressed comics that we would see later with 3-4, maybe 5 panels. Like they're full pages.
This,
like,
is meaty. And everyone that's in what it, I'm getting. All of the main characters, Matt, Karen, Foggy, Ben Urich, who's a big character, Kingpin, they all get an arc. They all get a pretty heavy story. Like, there's a lot going on in the book. Ben Urich's story is just as compelling as almost anybody else's story in here.
Sure.
And he's number 5 on the call sheet. You know, there's a lot going on here.
Karen Page gets a story. Glory kind of gets a story. Some of the folks involved, you know, in Kingpin's operation gets a story. Nuke gets a story.
And then at the end, he writes a... new Captain America Daredevil story that made me really wish Frank Miller had written Captain America.
You're not kidding.
I was really astounded. I mean, this is Frank Miller at age 29. We're living in Hell's Kitchen. Making comics is one of the most compelling people making comics of all time, I think, that period. He's so good in this.
The only thing I'm loyal to is the Dream. Grabs the flag with one hand. I was like, Jesus!
Or where he says, sometimes I feel weak because it's just a piece of cloth. And then another time when he finds out that all these bad things have happened with Super Soldier Serum, and there's a great overhead shot of Cap at the computer with the bodies of the guards he's had to knock out behind him. He's just got his hands in his lap, taking it all in. Like, it's incredible. It's a really incredible book. It lives up to everything.
But one other bit about it that I think is interesting is that we tend to go back and we look at 1986 as the year of the quote-unquote grim and gritty. And as I was reading this, there's definitely some sort of heavy, dark stuff, but there is still a touch of comic book fun. Like, there's a wink to sort of the noirish language used. And, you know, like, I don't feel like it's fully self-serious, I guess.
Maybe.
It is pretty serious, probably, compared to the ones that came before it. But then when we think about the stuff that aped this afterwards, I don't think it had the same... Like, this has its influences on its sleeve to a certain extent. And I was really surprised that we're talking about Frank Miller, who, I guess, you know, is 29 at the time. This is a pre-internet age.
Yep.
He knows a lot of things. Like, I was like, he writes a really good Irish accent. You know, like, and how would he know to do that? You know, unless he knows a lot of Irish people.
He was living in Hell's Kitchen. Irish,
I know. But, like, the point being, like, you know, you learn stuff now through the internet and podcasts and stuff like that. You know, before that, you'd see stuff from movies or from living it. And you just get a broad scope of influences on a person who is pretty damn young in a place where information was much harder to come by.
Mm-hmm.
And that was impressive to me. But also, I thought it was fun. Like, it was rollicking. It wasn't just grim for grim's sake.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely that in it. I mean, Karen Page's story is pretty grim.
Yes.
Also interesting, so in the first issue, you know, Matt is Daredevil, he saw the semblance of his life, Kingpin destroys it, and then he's not in costume again until the last issue of the story. The last page of the second to last issue. It's basically the last, like, you've got this entire arc, you know, that was monthly for like 4 or 5 months where he was just Matt Murdock with the stubble stumbling around New York.
Can you imagine the letters?
I'm very curious what that reaction
like
was.
This?
Yeah. I also noticed that for at least 3 or 4 issues, the book opens with Matt in bed. You know, the opening splash page of him either recovering from an injury in bed or asleep. At least the first 3 issues open that way. So Matt loses his job. He's under federal investigation. His apartment building gets blown up.
Disbarred.
He's disbarred. His girlfriend leaves him and starts dating Foggy. Like, everything is going wrong for him because Kingpin is now dismantling his enemy. And Kingpin thinks he murders Matt by dumping his body in a taxi and sending it over into the river in the classic film noir way, but he escapes. Meanwhile, you've got Ben Urich investigating things, and he gets attacked by Kingpin's men. He gets traumatized by Kingpin's, a really awesome sort of Frank Miller-esque character in that nurse who's his hitman. Oh. I mean, there's a lot going on. What I loved when Urich was like spiraling, that's when his character got really cartoony looking.
He gets looked like a demon.
And that's when I saw like Asterius Polyp Mazzucchelli in that stuff. You know, he looks way more cartoony. So there's a lot going on. And there's some sequences that look straight out of Year One. And then most of it's this very sort of hybrid style.
Okay, yeah. I've seen images from this forever, but I really always thought that I thought they were the Frank Miller drawn comic books.
Right.
For a really long time. And it looks a lot like the Frank Miller drawn stuff in a way. Like the inking, I think, having not read it, I just expected it to look like Year One.
Right.
And it didn't. So I spent a lot of time looking for that. And actually, as we get closer to the end of it, there was more of that,
yes,
I think.
Yes.
It sort of smoothed out a little. And there were a couple pages where I was like, oh, that's directly from it. Not directly, but the style is sort of just obvious. But the whole time, I could not stop looking at what an incredible storyteller he is.
Mazzucchelli is incredible.
There are sequences. The sequence in the hospital room where the hired cops shoot the lady you're just talking about.
Yes.
And then there's the Ben Urich basically saves himself and Glory. I went back and read that several times.
Yeah.
It's an amazing sequence of comic book story. And she is taking pictures the whole time.
Right. It's like in the elevator. No, they're in like a little cell. Yeah.
Yeah. They're in the little holding cell.
Yeah.
And the way that, if you look through that, the way that this was the part where before the fight starts, there's a lot of crosstalk going on in the dialogue. And I was like, this letterer is amazing. The letterer is credited as Joe Rosen. And I was fully prepared to give him tons of credit. Then I went and I looked at the end. You can see the layout pages. Matt Kelly placed all the balloons and drew all the sound effects.
Right.
So the letterer put the words in there and did a fine job at it. But as far as like the flow and the storytelling, like he did that on his own. Like he took control of that too. And it created this incredibly organic sort of thing that at times is hard to follow, but only intentionally so. So in that scene that we're talking about in the holding cell, there's a bit where like you see the hand reach back in the middle of another conversation and it says chichik under there. And then two or three word balloons later, you don't have to lock that. And then the next is the gun coming out. It is not only efficient storytelling, like it's super compelling looking.
There's a great rhythm to the sound effects. Blam, click, blam, 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 click, blam, click, 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 blam, click, click, blam. It is very intentional in the way that this is. If this is a film, you would hear this. It would be this great set, gunshot click off her camera, gunshot click. It's really great.
Yes.
I really like the nuke story at the end, and it's great. We're going to talk about it, but really, what I thought was really successful was the way that everywhere Matt turned, Kingpin had an answer, and the way the claustrophobic nature of it was really visceral. You know, my life isn't being caught in a vice by the Kingpin, but I've certainly had things go wrong for me every time I've turned around, and so I felt I could relate really strongly to what Matt was going through in a certain way, in a certain emotional way. Like, you know, I can't necessarily relate to him punching a guy on the rooftops, but I can relate to him. Every time he turns around, he tries to make his life better. It gets worse. It was this suffocating sense of, what is he going to do? He can't do anything.
And then the parallel of Ben Urich trying to do his job at the same time, and because of who the Kingpin is and what he is, like, he can't get that done either.
Yeah, every time he turns around, there's another Kingpin. So, like, there's the janitor at the Daily Bugle's like, hey, we're watching you, buddy.
Yeah, and they go after his wife, and he's defeated at one point. He's like, well, I'm not going to do it. And then, you know, he hears the person get killed over the phone, the police officer who turned because he was trying to save his son. And then his son died. And then,
But then also there's a great scene with J. Jonah Jameson. He's like, we don't get intimidated at the Daily Bugle.
Yeah.
We're going to publish this story. And I was like, you go, J. Jonah Jameson.
That page is beautiful.
Yeah.
With the noir shades.
Oh, anytime Mazzucchelli could do the light through blinds.
Jesus.
Was a good time. He did a lot, and it worked every time. Frank Miller, you know, a long time ago, we've mentioned this before, a long time ago when we were doing our video show, we were at one point going to rank, you know, all-time people who made comics. And, you know, he's, say whatever you want about him now, but he deserves to be in the conversation in the all-time great category.
Oh, yeah.
He is reinventing comics in the pages of this book along with Batman right in front of your eyes. And I can't imagine what it was like to read this book as comics take a quantum leap forward from the Bronze Age. I mean, he clearly saw something. He saw what comics could be.
I bet it felt similar. Can't be the same thing, but the feeling of reading Warren Ellis' Authority.
Mm-hmm.
That's the closest I think we can come to that we experienced. I mean, I read comics around, I don't say 88, you know, but I was a kid, so I couldn't really appreciate them.
You weren't reading them all, you know, all the time. And
yeah, I would say that somewhere between, like, we saw an epoch shift around 2000 with Warren Ellis and Brian Bendis bringing in new storytelling styles that were then aped and sort of went on, and that's close, but this seems bigger than that.
Yes.
I don't know. I don't know if you would have realized it at the time. I'm sure some people did. I bet pros certainly did, or you know, like adults. Mm. Adults weren't all reading comics then. It was, you know.
Some were, for sure. They were, yeah. But college kids, definitely.
Yeah.
Kingpin is really good in this.
Yes.
He's still a little bit of, like, he calls himself the Kingpin of Crime. Like, you know, he's, but he's at this point trying to go legitimate in that story that they've been doing ever since then. But he's gigantic. He's constantly lifting weights. He's beating up he's also a compelling character.
I think the thing that's interesting about this is that, like, a lot of these things I have seen since then.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen Down and Out Matt. I've seen Womanizing Matt. I've seen, you know, them proving that Kingpin is scary but calm, and he's fat but he takes care of himself, you know, and he's strong. And a lot of times when that happens, when you've seen something so many times, when you go back to the thing that started it, that thing seems less than.
Mm-hmm.
But in this, when we go back to the thing that started, it's like, oh, this is better than all the things that tried to do what it was doing afterwards.
Right.
Immeasurably so.
There's such great dialogue in this. And I say dialogue because a lot, most of the captions are, as we saw from this point forward, the inner thoughts of the characters. There's a scene where Yurik is leaving the police station after he's gotten police protection.
The big Swede.
Whatever I do say is enough to convince him to graft a 6-foot Swede to my hip. That is a great line.
Yes.
I mean, he's working on a different level than people were. There were other great comics, obviously. Alan Moore was writing at the time. Other people, Claremont was doing in Marv Wolfman, but different kinds of, and this is just a different kind of comic book. Imagine what a 29-year-old Frank Miller Avengers book would have been like after you see the Avengers briefly at the end of this. It would have been bonkers. It would have been bonkers. Well, like, what was your favorite? I mean, it's all one story basically. But what was your favorite sort of bit of it?
I mentioned that bit with Ben Urich in the holding cell. Like, I went back and read that a bunch of times, and I was like, "That's amazing." And also, notably, Daredevil has nothing to do with it. And I just kept reading sort of how that was done. You know, the stuff with Nuke. That's a character who, anytime he's shown up since then, I'm like, ugh, I can't stand this character. And the reason is, and now I know why he shows up, because everybody saw, you know, whoever it is read this and is like, I gotta do something with him someday. But this is just better. And the way that he was, like, they had to have Captain America show up to react to him in a certain way and have compassion for him.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, so it was a sad Captain America, oddly enough.
Yes.
Like, when he shows up, you know, Daredevil's like, I'm in trouble. I know it is. And it's not. It's Captain America trying to come to terms with it on his own. I liked all that stuff. I was talking about how like, it's stuff that we've seen in the past, but has never been that this is better. The Foggy and Matt stuff is great in that. I think Foggy and his relationship in this is really great in that, like, Foggy's not mad at him. He's not like, this is enough. I've had enough, which is pretty much what we've read since then.
Right.
I feel like.
I think Foggy is very quietly one of the best characters in this story.
Yeah, there's a bit where he's hanging out with Glory, and then that's also awkward because he's they don't say it, but they basically intimate that there's a relationship going on between them. It's very indirect for most of it. I can't remember if this is a time where it was direct, but for most
it unfolds slowly because she's just left Matt. Yeah.
It's implied, though.
He's clearly liked her before, as we saw in the issue from previous. She's beautiful, and she's Irish, and you know how that goes. You know, it's a very organic thing where at first it's because she doesn't know where else to go. She just, and you know, Matt's life's falling apart, and that's affecting her life. And then they just sort of hang out and have dinner and go shopping, and they're just all of a sudden they're in a relationship. And it's never really talked about. Matt goes back to Karen. He never really says, "Hey, what are you guys doing?"
Right. But there's one of those bits, though, where he's talking about it, and he's, you know, he's defending Matt in a way, but not like you should take him back. But he's saying, you know what, you know, there was this one time in college, you should have seen him back then. And, like, he loves the guy.
Yeah.
And that really came through. I also thought there's a bunch of this in here that I was like, all of the things that I've always said are extra great about Garth Ennis's character and relationship work, I see in here.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it. It's not the same style of writing at the end of the day, but the way that those characters were portrayed and the way that their relationship, I haven't seen a lot of other people do that the way that Garth Ennis does. And I saw a lot of it in here with that Foggy and Glory stuff and with, you know, with Matt Murdock.
Yeah, Foggy's never mad at Matt. And Matt's done nothing wrong, but he's never mad at him. He swoops in. He represents him in court very well. He tries his best to help when he, you know, in any way he can. Mostly he can't, but he's just there emotionally for him. He's a great character.
There's a scene in if you're looking at the book, it's page 159. After the first Nuke shows up and shoots a bunch of people, and there's people are convalescing in the church.
Mm-hmm.
The third panel is just all these people laying down in the pews, and the word balloons are all over the place. But there's a story that goes on in between there, and Foggy finds his way to Glory. And there's this little weird thing where she's like, I need to ask you a favor. You got to, you know, take this film to the Daily Bugle. It's almost like they break up for a second. Maybe that's not in that scene. Oh, that's it. She's asking to bring the film to the Daily Bugle. And he's kind of like, okay, you should go to the hospital. And she's just, take them over there. And he's like, well, I'll be seeing you, sweetie. And she's like, sure, Foggy, I'll call you. I don't know, but it was just, it was subtle. I read it back a few times. I was like, what's going on here? Not in a confusing way. It's just those little character bits, I think, were really strong. The dialogue, that's another example, is just super strong.
One thing that came through, not as strongly as in The Dark Knight, but it was more of an undercurrent, is that clearly Frank Miller's disdain for New York at the time.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, totally.
86, I was living in New York. I was alive. It was a rougher place than it is now, much rougher. Mm-hmm. He's gone on record saying, you know, a lot of this came out of being horribly mugged and beaten up when he was living there. And so a lot of his Dark Knight stuff came out of that. But here, you know, New York is not a great place. At one point, Foggy and Glory are Christmas shopping and somebody tries to grab her purse and she fights back and the guy tries to stab her. Meanwhile, everyone's just walking past them. And I was like, yep, there's Frank Miller who wrote The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
Right there.
I loved that she was having none of that shit because she's from Belfast during the Troubles.
Right. But yeah, so once Daredevil's born again, you know, he comes back, he saves Karen from her creepy guy that's got her under his sway, and he gets...
Paolo,
the Italian with gray skin. He gets his life back in some way, he puts the costume back on, he reasserts his life from Kingpin. And then we get the one or two issues. Is it one issue of the Nuke story?
It's a couple. Because there's the one where he shows up in Hell's Kitchen, and then there's the one where he breaks out.
So Nuke is a character we've seen a lot in comics. He's the guy who got the Super Soldier Serum, or version of it, because they never got to crack it.
I looked it up. This was his first appearance, which I didn't. I was wanted to make sure.
So throughout the issue, Kingpin's trying to hire people to kill Daredevil. He hires a string of psychopaths. So at the end, he goes, "Bring me Nuke." And so he calls up a general who he has blackmail material on, and they send in Nuke, who's got the face tattoo of the American flag and the blonde hair, and he's got machine guns, and he's being pulled out of the jungle, wherever the jungle he is in the jungle. 86, Vietnam was well over.
Could have been in South America.
To come to Hell's Kitchen and kill Daredevil. Obviously, it goes out of control. They start destroying Hell's Kitchen. The Avengers show up. There's a great sequence with Iron Man and Thor and Captain America.
Subtle. I thought I was like, oh, the Avengers are going to fight. And I was like, no, we just get this one page.
And it was great. Great Thor.
The Thor is great. The rain starts falling so hard it hurts. I was like, poof.
So then it becomes Captain America's problem, because this guy is basically Captain America light. And it's not so much a team-up as a... two characters at similar purposes. Mm-hmm. But all the Cap stuff was incredible with the generals.
Yeah.
He's not really with them, but he's Captain America, so what can they do? And he's like, you're one of us. And the scene you talked about, I'm loyal to nothing, general, except the dream, which is like, you know, chum in the water for Cap fans.
I also noticed that every time that they show Cap, he stands at attention like a soldier. Mm-hmm. Like his posture is soldier. I know that is, you know.
He's ramrod straight.
Right. Like it's exaggerated in a way that I noticed it, you know, and I've seen Captain, you know, you're not used to seeing him slouching, but it was like he was in the general's, you know, office and he's standing up straight, but he still speaks truth to power. That mm-hmm. that panel where he grabs the flag, I just kept looking at it. Like, I want this page. This page is beautiful. And there's not Daredevil in it, but I'm sure.
He tries not to resent the computers. Only an old man would.
That was beautiful.
But and then, you know, he finds out that there's been a whole string of people who've been gotten the serum and they're all dead except for Nuke. And then he has to take Nuke out. And there's a great fight sequence with him and Nuke where they go crashing through walls. But he also he doesn't want to hurt. He feels compassion for Nuke because Nuke has been destroyed by this program where he's turned into the psychopath who's been given amphetamines to go shoot people with machine guns. So when he subdues Nuke, but then he's like, on your feet, soldier, I'm going to get you to the hospital, you know?
And then all the guys who were flying the helicopters who were shooting at them, he's now in command of that helicopter, which was weird.
Who?
Or no, those soldiers are there to get Nuke. That's what it is.
They try to kill Nuke. And they shoot
Daredevil
him. Daredevil
flies in from out of nowhere.
Right, and gets Nuke in a cab and drives a cab even though he's blind. Like, it was all kinds of great stuff.
That was great. The panel at the end of that where Daredevil jumps in, where there's 1, 2, 3, 4, there's 6 soldiers, and they go, sir, we can't look. I respect that, Lieutenant. And they all stop. That panel is amazing. There's 7 people in that panel, and they're all beautifully rendered, and like their poses are like his anatomy is amazing.
This is one issue. This is just one issue with Nuke. Nuke and Cap, I mean.
Oh, okay.
And then there's a great 2 full page shots at the end of the issue. In between one other page where he drops Nuke on Ben Urich's desk. That's a great page.
It is.
With the water pooling everywhere. And then, you know, the ending of the story is Matt with his Sunday best sweater on with Karen, and they're happily walking through a rebuilding Hell's Kitchen with Mazzucchelli's signature at the bottom. And that's the capper.
I stared at that page because one thing, they don't really look all that out of time right there.
No, they could be right now.
Yeah, that draw, like, and it's funny because if you look, all right, say that you go read, we talked about this all the time, if you talk about Alan Davis or something like that, and right. You read his stuff, it's like, well, everybody looks like they're from the 80s. This book looked pretty fucking timeless to me.
Yes.
There was not a ton of, like, ooh, that's not, like, I don't know how he got away with that timelessness.
It's a very modern, I mean, we know this, Mazzucchelli is a genius.
I know, but even the book. But even the way that, like, the hair and the characters are drawn, like, he didn't make it of the time. He didn't try to put like a mullet on Matt or anything like that. It's just right. sort of a classic.
No gimmicks needed.
None.
Well, not until the 90s and they had armor to his costume, but that's not Matt's choice fault. I was blown away. I probably read this when I was a kid. There's a lot of things you remember don't really affect you the way you, as an adult, who's spent 20 years analyzing comics has. I couldn't put it down. I did at one point. I read, ironically, because there's so much back matter in this collection, mm-hmm. I thought I was like halfway, two-thirds way through the book. I put it down for the last issue. I was like, oh, there's a lot left. I got to run and do something. It was literally the start of the Captain America issue when I stopped.
Do you spend time looking at those layouts in the back matter, by the way?
Oh, yeah. And there's the script pages in the back.
Yeah. But the script pages are great.
That Frank did on the typewriter.
Yeah. I mean, but they're like, they read like a novel.
They're economical.
Yep. They're really great. And then, you know, if you look at the layouts that Mazzucchelli did, like, I don't know that they're thumbnails or not, but like all the anatomy, all the shape, like it's all right there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he's such a good draftsman. It's crazy.
Yeah, so this is the entire script for that Nuke issue.
Yeah.
It's crazy. That might have been the best issue. There's a lot of great issues, but this might have been the best.
It definitely had like a culmination, kind of like everything coming together and blowing up. And
his cap was so good.
Yes, it was.
It's so good. It is interesting to go back and read the foundational elements of what you're reading now, because this is still not exactly like this anymore, because we had the decompression era that came in, and mm-hmm. now you've got the sort of muddled hybrid storytelling style, but this is basically how comics are written now.
I feel like this is what everyone's trying to do.
Yeah, the first person narration, this is where it all came from.
And it's also like, it's clear that like everybody who wrote Daredevil after this had this in mind.
Mm-hmm.
It must have been really hard not to. And when I first got back into comics, I was reading Kevin Smith's, you know, Marvel Knights Daredevil.
Mm-hmm.
That was a goddamn love letter to this.
Yeah, and the thing is, there's been a lot of great runs on Daredevil.
Yeah.
This was not even Frank Miller's first run. He had an original run you know, sort of saved the character from cancellation originally, and he came back for this one. You had Kevin Smith, you had Mark Waid, you had Ed Brubaker, you had Brian Bendis. You had five or six really classic runs of Daredevil. And it must be the allure of Frank Miller's Daredevil.
Well, what's funny is that I originally, a long time ago, bought the Frank Miller Daredevils were coming out in the trades.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I have three of them. And I didn't love it.
Mm-hmm.
It was beautiful. Like, I really like, you know, it's the Daredevil Elektra story. So it was sort of a classic thing I wanted to have read. And he didn't draw. No, he didn't write the first parts of it. And then later he drew and wrote. And it was good. Like, I could tell. I'm going to go back. I should go back and read it.
Well, you can see here that, like I said, with the issue before, it's not written like this.
Yeah, exactly. So I wasn't blown away. And that might have been one of the reasons I just never did this.
Because
I just thought, you know, those, you know, I read those. I'm glad I did. But they didn't blow me away or anything. This is so much better than that. I always tend to think that the best Frank Miller Daredevil story is Elektra Bullseye stuff. It's not. This is so much better than that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he drew some of that.
He started in 79 on Daredevil. So
yeah.
He was 22
yeah.
when he started writing Daredevil.
That's how old Garth Ennis was when he started doing like Hellblazer and stuff.
Right.
I think he was 23 maybe when he started Preacher.
10 issues later, he was writing and drawing it. He finished his original run of 191 in 83. So he was gone for 3 years.
What's interesting, too, is if you think about Frank Miller, he definitely underwent his transformation at a certain point. And I mean this stylistically. I don't mean ideologically or any of that stuff. This stuff, this Daredevil stuff and Dark Knight Returns, super dense. It's mm-hmm. kind of like, I use the word swirling. Like, just a lot of stuff happening at once and sort of, you know, you'll be looking at something and another voice comes in for a second. Then you go back to what you were doing. And then he stripped all that down a lot
mm-hmm.
to sort of what he would do. I don't want to say now, because now is different. I don't know. It doesn't work the same way now as it did then, but, you know, like, it's just a marked sort of change from sort of where he ended up. But what he did here with putting in such a dense amount of content worked really well, but it must be exhausting.
I mean, as a reader, I never felt overwhelmed. There's certainly comics from this era that make you feel overwhelmed, and there's comics from mm-hmm. any era. I mean, I still joke about that first issue of Superman from the 52. It still made me feel tired to think about it. But there's a lot here, but because of the quality, like I always say.
Yeah, no.
The quality of the words is more important than the number of the words. And this is, he's got the best words here.
He just has the best words. And everybody's hands are right size.
It's all good. I mean, no matter how many captions or a thing, it's all really compelling. He's dived deep into noir. It switches to Yurik. Yurik has his own voice, and then his captions are all in like typewriter set, and his voice is great. He's the hard-nosed, hard-boiled noir reporter. Like, everyone has their own distinct narration.
Is this the first sort of Ben Urich as this?
I don't know.
Trying to remember if he was in the earlier stuff. I think he was.
I'm sure he was. Yeah, I mean, he had been around for 10 years or 8 years at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, but you've got to believe that this is all a leveling up for all these characters.
Sure. No, absolutely.
I think everyone needs to read this.
Yeah.
I think everyone needs to read this. It's not Dark Knight or Watchmen, but it's right underneath that.
Well, I would have considered, historically, I've considered Year One a, I guess, more accessible than Dark Knight Returns.
Mm-hmm.
But that's actually 2 years later in its when it came out.
Right.
But if you like Year One and haven't read this, that doesn't make sense.
Boy, I don't know.
Yeah, no, like I feel like wow, I blew it.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of comics. And this book doesn't get overshadowed. I want to say that because
yep.
Marvel historically has had fewer books that you could point to that are all-time classics that you could hand someone in a single volume. That's always sort of been DC's ballywick.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel has them, but not as many. But this is one of them.
Do you think this stands out stronger to you, though, from a craft standpoint than anything else? That's the only thing I would take away from that is that as watching this now, again, after sort of having to talk about comics the way that we do for the last 20 years, the craft of it was astounding. It was still compelling to me and it was fun for all those reasons, but I don't know that the layperson will necessarily.
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's definitely there, but what the craft results in is a really compelling Daredevil story.
I mean, if the craft is working, then you won't necessarily notice to still enjoy it. So there's that.
Yeah, and the story's great. This is the foundational Daredevil story. Daredevil's been around for a long time, but this is the story that sort of all Daredevil stories come from after this.
Yes, absolutely.
So, I mean, if you're a Daredevil fan, and you haven't read this, you need to go get it right now.
It's amazing that they could bollocks up that first movie as bad as they did.
Yeah.
With all the great stuff they had to work with.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, everyone's chasing this.
Still.
Everyone's still chasing 86.
I know artists are. Yeah. Mazzucchelli on this and on, you know, like Mazzucchelli's mainstream comic book work, I feel like is, I know about it because it's the way that artists talk about it, like the reverential sort of look at what that guy's done.
Mm-hmm.
Like you'd be hard pressed to find a guy who's better.
Yeah. No, yeah. I was literally at a party last night and we were in Mike Romo's house, our old iFanboy buddy, and we were looking at his comics and pulled out a Serious Polyp and showing my buddy's fiance the book and she was loving the art. And I was like, now this guy did this. And I pulled out Year One. I was like, the same guy. He's astounding.
Year One's my favorite art style. I love this art.
Yeah.
But Year One like is just like take all of it away and just make it, you know, as succinct and beautiful as possible.
Only with just the lines you need.
Yep. I did come out of this going, I got to read Asterius Polyp again. It's been a little while.
I don't think I've read it since it came out.
No, I know I haven't. I know I read it like a second time because we did a show about it or did something because it was Book of the Year.
Maybe.
I think I wrote that, so I had to like study it more, but so it's been a while.
I would like to make sure this is understood. This is a craft tour de force. It's also a rollicking good time reading.
It's a really fun comic.
So don't think we're saying this is like a dry craft exercise. Like this is a really incredibly fun comic. Incredibly compelling. I couldn't put it down.
And what I was saying before, but when I was saying, you know, like it's grim and gritty, but not like grim and gritty sometimes isn't fun. This is fun. And that is kind of the point. Like it was still a comic book, you know, it wasn't trying to prove to me that comics aren't for kids anymore. It was just trying to prove to me that comics could be good and fun.
It's mature. Again, it's in that nebulous time where one age is ending and another is beginning, so it's birthing it, and so there's a little bit of both in it. There's a little bit of Bronze Age-iness stuff, but there's a lot more Modern Age stuff in it. God, it's a good-looking book, though.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got that really iconic cover. I don't think I realize or think about how iconic that cover is until I was looking at all the variant versions of it in the back, that shot of Matt and Karen in the church. That's just a very iconic piece.
Yeah. His composition, his page composition, and just sort of, in addition to just the storytelling, is just wonderful.
Yeah, this collection, this one we have is the black cover. I believe it came out in 07.
Yeah, it's kind of old, but it's just been reprinted.
No, this is 2018, the seventh printing of this. If you're into process, man, this back matter is terrific. These sketch pages.
I never read that stuff, and I was right on this. Look at page 97, that first panel.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Look at the triangle that's sort of mixed with the perspective. It's sort of hinting at a Holy Trinity at the same time, but it all just fits in with the actual visual perspective on the art. I got, mm-hmm. Who does that?
That's incredible.
Who does that? That's amazing.
Page 99, I like to point out that Matt is still an Irish kid from Hell's Kitchen because he's got the giant gold cross.
Yep.
Showing.
He talks about the gold cross a lot.
Right, but like, you know, we sometimes forget he's like, you know, he could have been a Westie.
It's true. Just another Mick.
So, Daredevil Born Again, David Miller and David Mazzucchelli. How do you say, is it Mazzucchelli or Mazzucchelli?
I'm not sure, but it's definitely Frank Miller, not David Miller.
It's not David Miller? Are we sure?
I'm pretty sure. I mean, I'm reading it.
That was his pen name.
I'm guessing that no one's ever got Mazzucchelli's name right.
Frank Miller, David Mazzucchelli, Dennis Yankee did some of the art in 226. Christy Scheel and Richmond Lewis were colorists. Joe Rosen was a letterer. Ralph Macchio, that's how you say his name.
Like the color in this, too.
Is the editor. Yes.
Color's great.
It gets kind of psychedelic at some points.
Yeah, but it's not... I don't know. It's the color's right. Again, it feels timeless in that way.
Go get it.
Yep.
Go get it, people.
Go get it now.
All right, so are we doing ratings? Do we even have to?
Five.
Five?
I mean, okay. Can I go higher?
5.5? 5.25?
10.
5 stars. All the stars five you can stars. Give. Whatever rating scale you get, it'll fill the scale.
Yep.
Born Again, one of the great Marvel stories, one of the great Daredevil stories. It will reinforce to you that 86 was the most important year in comics. Other than the creation of comics, and yep. That Frank Miller is legitimate legend.
Yep.
Comic book legend. So check it out. Go to iFanboy.com. There'll be posts for this show if you want to talk about it. But if you don't, there's still shows there. You can find our Pickle League podcast where Josh and I talk about the week's new books and all of our special edition shows. The Talksplode show that we should mention, this show was unlocked by our patrons over at patreon.com/iFanboy. They also unlocked the Talksplode, Josh's interview show that switches off with this show, which will be coming out next month. And we'll be back in 2 months with another book to talk about.
What's the point?
Yeah, what is the point?
It's whatever it is going to suck. Where do you place this on the Born Again scale? Less.
Until then, I'm Connor.
Josh.
I mean, let's do year one.
All right, then. He's got to be lost to be found. Hard to be fair when you fight, when the devil spins the world around. It's hard to be nice when you lose, when the devil spins the world around. And wish you were thunder and light, when the devil spins the world around. Oh, yeah. Stuck with the blue, when the devil spins the world around. You gotta be lost to be found, when the devil spins the world around. You gotta be lost to be found, when the devil spins the world around. You gotta be lost to be found, when the devil spins the world around. You know the signs of a cold down. But it is what it is, and it isn't what it ain't. Doesn't matter what it was, cause you know it's gonna keep on. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.